Franklin, and our guest today is Eden Robbins, who is the author of the novel When Franny Stands Up, which was named a Best Book of 2022 by the Chicago Reader and a Best Queer Book of 2022 by Autostraddle. Her short stories and essays have appeared in Slate, USA Today, LA Review of Books, Catapult, and others. She lives in Chicago, has been to the bottom of the ocean, which actually is relevant to this book, and will never go to space. The book that we're talking about today is Remember You Will Die. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Eden.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so let's just start out by saying Remember You Will Die is not your normal novel.
Right.
So I'm curious, was When Franny Stands Up more normal, or was it also very unusual?
Well, in my mind, it was very normal, but according to some, it was a little unusual as well. But it was very structurally usual. It
had
beginning, middle, end, a normal narration. It was a typical linear story.
Okay, so let's just describe what Remember You Will Die, what the structure of this book is.
Yeah, the structure actually was the thing that took me the longest to figure out. It is a story, it's a novel written exclusively through linked obituaries, etymologies, news clippings, things like that. But mostly, I'd say about 90% obituaries. There is no standard narration. The story is told out of order. And although it is theoretically about the relationship between two people, it spans 300 years and let's say 60 plus characters are in it and they're all dead.
Okay. So I got to admit, as a reader, I almost felt like I should be making a map.
It's funny, as a writer, I did make a map.
I'm sure you did. And I think you should share it with your readers.
Yeah, I have. It's so funny. I did. This was during the last edit that I did for this book. My husband helped me. We did a timeline of all the characters. I did a family tree, just all on massive pieces of newsprint. And I do have those scanned. I should post those on social media.
You really should. You really should. Yeah. Okay. So not only is it unusual in the structure and the kind of the characters themselves, how many there are and how linked they are and how, but if you, this is actually a book that I suggest that you can't read over, you can't pick it up, read a bit, put it down, come back a week later. You almost have to read it start to finish within a few days, I think, to.
I think there's different ways. I mean, I can say this as the writer, but I think there are different ways to read the book and you'll get different things out of it depending on how you do it.
That makes sense.
There is the, read it all the way through so you can pick up on everything.
Right.
But I wrote it specifically so people would feel carried along by it. And you can also read the individual obits as kind of like short stories and take a little bit at a time and absorb it and then move on. So I know some people have come to me and been like, oh, I'm really stressed out by this book. I'm worried I'm going to miss something. And I'm like, actually, beneath it all, it's like a pretty simple story. It has to be with this structure. And all the other stuff is kind of like an extra bonus. So you can pick up on it while you read it, or you can come back and read it later, or you can just not worry about it and let it wash over you. I think it can be read in any of those different ways.
Okay. That makes sense. Makes sense. So the story underlying everything is about artificial intelligence. So give us a little bit of a background of that and why you wrote about that.
So I knew with a complicated story like this or a complicated structure that there needed to be sort of a core emotional heart of it. And it kind of emerged out of the structure. I didn't go into this with an idea of what the story was going to be about. I just wanted to write a novel of linked obituaries, and I figured it would all come together at some point.
Okay, so that structure was where you started.
The idea of the structure.
The idea.
Yeah, but the you know what I would do is I would sit down every day. This was during like the height of the pandemic. I would sit down every day and just think of what I was interested in that day and come up with a person who lived that life. And then
wow.
The next day I would do something else. And so I had a lot of stuff on my mind, obviously. And then over time, the story kind of started to emerge. So where the AI stuff came from is I had this collection of obituaries. They told this story about misfits and art and legacy and sort of the future that we're hurtling towards. You know, I mean, I'm thinking we're recording this today during the fires in LA, you know,
yeah.
So.
And a blizzard in Dallas.
And a blizzard in Dallas. And like, what is the future that we're hurtling towards? And all of this stuff was on my mind. And so I had these collection of obituaries that's about grief. And I started to think like, well, who's compiling these obituaries? Who is searching for these and why? And it occurred to me that there could be an entity that wasn't human who is struggling with this idea of grief and what it meant to grieve and what it meant to experience loss, but having no context or knowledge of how that's supposed to go. And grief is foreign to us humans, even though we're all going to experience it at some time or other, it still feels like this completely destabilizing emotion. So how might something who's not human cope with grief? And I thought maybe they were searching through obituaries to deal with it. And then just came the question of like, well, why? What is this grief that this AI is experiencing? And that's kind of how that story started to come together.
Okay. All right. So how much do you know about AI?
Well, there are two answers to this question. one is that I worked for a mental health app that used AI before ChatGPT came out. So I had an understanding of like what a large language model was, what its capabilities are, what its limitations were, a little bit already. And then it was also just sort of starting to come into public consciousness with ChatGPT, and I read a bunch of articles about it, and sort of I was most interested in not even the tool itself, but how the way we map our anxieties onto technology and the things that we are worried about have to do with the things we're worried about in ourselves. And also as a science fiction writer, I don't feel super comfortable writing about topics like AI, like space travel, things like that, because I feel like there's a language that people talk about this with, and I just didn't have it. But then I thought, well, I'm a fiction writer. I can write about this however I want. And so I just decided to dig into my own interests and then map AI to that.
I mean, is this considered science fiction or?
People seem to. I think, you know, one of the things I've encountered.
I mean, did you set out to write a science fiction book?
No, I did not. I did not. This is just the stuff that came up because, like I said, I feel uncomfortable with some of the subject matter. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have a science background?
I do. I was a biology major in college and then never used it again.
Oh, wow.
And then I actually, this is a longer story, but I made friends with some deep sea marine biologists and ended up going on two research expeditions with them.
To the bottom of the ocean.
One to the bottom of the ocean. Yeah. And then I wrote essays for this. So they let me on board as a writer and they're like, can you just please write about this? And I was like, sure.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So one of them was I got to go to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico in the Alvin submersible, which was really cool. That's the submersible that found the Titanic.
Okay. So you must have something to say about that one that blew up.
I do. Yeah, I wrote an essay about it for Slate, actually.
So what happened there?
The Titan?
Yeah.
Well, the thing, I had talked to my deep sea scientist friend about this, and the thing that seemed to be the biggest issue is maybe not the biggest issue, I'm not an expert here, but all of the submersibles that we use for research are spheres for a reason, because they can withstand the great pressures of the deep sea, whereas the Titan was like capsule shaped. And that's not great for for deep sea pressures. But they were trying to, you know, they were trying to disrupt and innovate this field that they knew nothing about. So it's tragic and horrible.
But
research deep sea research is actually quite safe, and being in like something like the Alvin is quite safe.
Really? Mm-hmm. I think it's terrifying.
A lot of people do. That's so funny. I think I said in my bio, I will never go to space, but I will go to the bottom of the ocean again and again. Happy to do it.
Wow. So tell us how going to the bottom of the ocean figures into Remember You Will Die.
Yeah. So as you might imagine, when you're writing a book of many dozens of obituaries, you can cover a lot of ground in subject matter. And so, you know, I had been in the Alvin submersible, believe it or not, February of 2020. I was flying home from the New Orleans airport at the end of February.
Oh, my.
So when the pandemic hit, I mean, two weeks later was all the lockdown stuff. So I had it on my mind, and it was just such a surreal experience just to see all of this stuff face to face. And so I don't know, I had been thinking a lot about the deep sea, and one of the things I was interested in. So the research that I was doing was with my friend, Dr. Craig McLean. He does these woodfall experiments where they drop logs basically to the bottom of the ocean, and then a couple months later they pull them back up and they see what's been eating them, and that is a way to determine what sort of the ecological web is at the bottom of the ocean, which they don't really know. So he's sort of trying to understand what's living, what's eating, what eats each other. Now there are other kinds of falls. There are whale falls. There was in fact a book called Whale Fall that came out last year. Basically, when a whale falls to the bottom of the ocean, it's this source of food, and then a lot of things eat it, and that's another thing that the scientists research. So I became interested in what if there was a human fall? There has never been one, but if there was a research experiment where somebody would drop a human body to the bottom of the ocean, what might we find there? And of course, so there is a scientist in the book who wants to do one of these things, has partnered with an artist who wants to make a kind of experimental art project out of it. And, you know, whose body do they use? All of this stuff sort of fed into the story.
And now people certainly have died in the ocean, but their bodies probably aren't heavy enough to sink to the bottom, are they?
Maybe, maybe not. I'm not sure exactly how that works. I'm actually not sure. I can't speak.
I'm just trying to imagine it kind of.
So one of the other experiments that we did was they did an alligator fall where they dropped a dead alligator to the bottom of the ocean, and that one had weights on it.
So there's the
weighted aspect. And then there's also just, it's even when you know where something is at the bottom of the ocean, it can be very hard to find.
Oh, yes, of course.
Unless you're like, these are my coordinates, I'm going to go back and look at it. Even then, like, we would look for things and couldn't find them, even though we knew exactly where we're supposed to be. So I think that people have died in the ocean, certainly, but they weren't subject to an experiment, as far as I know.
Right. I would think not. Now, this whole, the fact that this human fall was also kind of a performance art, mm-hmm. there's a lot of performance art, very weird stuff in this book. Is any of it things that have actually, you know, have been done, or is it all out of your imagination?
I don't know why I became so obsessed with performance art during this time, but there was just something, about it, about this mix of art and bodies and constructed environments that, you know, to sort of like pursuing this idea of what is natural and what is artificial. I had these kinds of things on my mind. So a lot of the performance art is based on real stuff, or it was inspired by things that I had seen or read about. And I was like, what an interesting idea. It's also such like a fertile ground to come up with something really weird. You know, like,
there's
so many, when you think of performance art, you can just pull from so many different disciplines, and with the right kind of mission statement, you can make it into art. So it was a really nice sort of groundwork to talk about different ideas and to place it in the realm of art.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Eden Robbins, author of Remember, You Will Die. All right, so let's backtrack a little bit. You were writing these obituaries just based on various subject matters.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't linked at that point, right? Or were they?
They were consciously linked. Well, because I was doing one a day, something, you know, I would write something one day and then something would pique my interest in what I had written, and I would maybe write about a person who was mentioned in a previous obituary
the next day. Okay.
Or there were kind of these lineages that were coming up, but I didn't start out with a plan. No.
Okay. So how did you go back and sort of tie everything together, and how long did that take?
So it's interesting. Usually when I write a novel or anything, most of the work is in the revision of the, like, I don't outline usually. Sometimes I do. but it's usually the content that gets revised. You know, this scene has to go. I add a new scene. I got to move this around. Got to rewrite. So I will often rewrite the whole thing at least once. With this, most of the obits that are in the book were the original ones that I wrote in the first draft. I changed some intro and outro. I think I got rid of one or two, and I added a few. But the majority of the content didn't change that much, which is really unusual for me and strange considering how the book is structured.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the best and worst things about writing this book is that it's very modular, and I think there are almost infinite ways to structure it depending on what you're trying to convey, which was both exciting and horrible. So the writing part didn't take that long, maybe less than a year. And then I think I reorganized everything 5 or 6 times, you know, sent it to people to read. They were like, I don't know, what are you doing?
You're a weirdo.
But ultimately the thing, I felt like I was getting closer and closer. I mean, I said, that's a lie, actually. I did not feel like I was getting closer and closer. At any given moment, I was like, I don't know if this is working at all. There was no point where I thought, this is great, I've done it. But the last stage was my husband and I I have a Scrivener file, if you know what that is. It's a writing software where you can list each chapter individually and move them around very easily. So I used that, and we walked through every single obituary, and I explained everything I was trying to do, and then I would cry, and then he would be like, no, this is great. Let's just move this here, do a little intro. Oh, here's a gap. You need to add something here. So he was really instrumental in helping me kind of see the structure of it. But as a book, it's nonlinear, so it was kind of an emotional arc that I was trying to convey and also give people the relevant information when they needed it so that they wouldn't feel stressed out while they were reading it.
Well, that, I mean, it's like a gigantic puzzle.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And there were a couple times I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that person, you talked about that person back here. What was the connection? And mm-hmm. That's why I said the map would really really help to see how everything was linked. So one of the things that's amazing about this book is actually how linked everything is in such odd ways.
Yes. Yep. And that was part of the, you know, making the map visually. Like one of the things that I noticed when I did the timeline was that I would originally, I had people who were meant to be siblings who had lived 50 years apart. And so I was like, oh, wait, no, I have to fix that. That's not right. But what it did was it lined up people by era. And so I could be like, oh, I hadn't thought about these people knowing of each other, but I could. And if I did, how could I link them? So that was really fun. And there are these kind of set pieces throughout that recur, partially because I was really interested in them, but also like it was a way, like there's a building in the book that is filled with artist lofts. And it was a way to connect the artists who lived in that, who lived in New York, by having them sort of rotate in and out of that building.
Now, is that a real building, a real place?
Well, it's based on a real building. there was a building in New York that was, I just thought was so interesting. It was an old diamond merchant building that had become, in the financial district, that had become this home for artists. And they had these below market rents, and some like really wonderful artists lived there, and they used to throw parties and all this stuff. And it kind of, what I thought was so wonderful about it was that in the financial district, which is a neighborhood that runs on commerce and finance and money, you had this little pocket of art, of people who were making their art and surviving and taking care of each other. And it just felt like this sort of hidden gem. And then, you know, was bought by a developer and everybody had to leave. Yeah. So that it was inspired by that place.
Now, there's at least one character in the book who was an actual historical figure. Mm-hmm. Are there others?
There are a lot of people who are inspired by historical figures, but there is only one I'm thinking about
that
now.
Has the same name. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That has the same name and is literally based on a historical figure. And that one is interesting to me. People ask me about that all the time. Like, why did you include this person? And the thing is, it happens right in the middle of the book. And it feels to me like I think of this book in a lot of different ways, but one of it is a structure of like a flower, a poppy. And the center,
a poppy.
And the center is, you know, what's that part of the flower? The middle part.
The stamen, or
stamen, maybe.
Yeah.
Or... And this character connects to the stem, which connects to the real world. And so for me, she was sort of like the tether. And I really wanted to, I'm not sure how much we wanted.
I know. So it's like an alternate history, mm-hmm. which, science fiction often does do some, you know, does play in alternate histories. Is this the only sort of really alternate history aspect of the book, or are there others? I think this is the primary one.
It's the primary one.
Yeah.
The others are, like I said, loosely based on yeah. actual things. But this is the
yeah.
really
so this character is somebody who all of us have heard of, but in this book, the reason that we've all heard of her no longer exists.
Yes.
But she's famous for another reason.
Yes. Or like not
another reason, but yeah, not nearly as famous and for a related reason. Now, mm-hmm. that is certainly going to inspire some curiosity, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to go read the book. Yeah. So, okay. So there were other characters that I wondered if they might be real, or you know, based on real people, and like the what was it, the snake lady?
Oh, the snake, the burlesque dancer.
Yeah, the burlesque dancer who wore snakes.
Weirdly, no, that was so funny enough. That was the first obit I wrote.
Seriously, mm-hmm. That's where you started.
Yep. And for a long time, that was the first one in the book, because in my mind, that was how the story started, because that was how I wrote it. Mm. She wasn't based on anybody, weirdly enough.
So what
But
was the inspiration for that? What was it that you were fascinated by that made you come up with this person?
I really like blending the highbrow and lowbrow. I really liked how she had this. Oh, this is actually, there is a real historical figure mentioned in her obit. I like how she kind of intertwined with real history. I liked the fantasy elements or the borderline, like, is it, isn't it fantasy? We don't know. And I really liked how all of those elements sort of melded together. I thought at the time also, I was, my mother-in-law was very ill, was living in a nursing home. And so I was just thinking about aging and sort of like the options or lack of options for us as we age and how somebody who could have had this very vibrant youth might have ended up basically forgotten and neglected. That's a little bit of a downer, but that was how that all of that stuff sort of combined. And then I also became interested. I had been reading a lot of obituaries, obviously, to sort of understand how they were written. And I liked the ones that had corrections to them. So this one also has a correction at the end because it had said she had no descendants, but then it turns out she did.
That's really interesting. And
And this idea
was that original too, like when you first wrote
that was
that,
original.
was part of it? Yeah.
I really was interested in this idea of like who gets to say what the shape of our lives were, how might those people be wrong, and in what ways, and how does being wrong open up these possibilities of who this person was and that we might not have even known. And actually, now that I think about it, at the same time, I had uncovered some secrets in my own family, that of people who had died many years ago, but had these sort of secrets that. So basically, what it, as it turns out, that my biological grandfather was not the grandfather I grew up with.
And you didn't know. You never
I
knew.
didn't know.
Isn't
I didn't know
that
that. It is so. I mean, it was so fascinating. It doesn't change my lived experience, but it's like, oh my gosh, now I thought I knew these people, and there are things about them I don't know.
We had a kind of a situation, a found cousin basically that no one had known about, and it was really fun to. And I was the person who actually found them and,
Oh,
on
fun.
Ancestry.com and connected them with their birth parent that they'd been looking for 40 years.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
The member of my family who was the ancestor of this or the parent of this person was so happy to have found this person
Oh
and.
my gosh, that's
I
wonderful.
know, I know. It
That's
was really delightful.
so cool. And it's so, I mean, it's so funny how, I mean, this is just such an, I'm really interested in, how our sort of bodily lived experiences meshes or interacts with technology. And so you have this like nobody in that generation ever thought that this stuff would come up, and it's coming up so much because of genetic testing. And it's like, how does that impact us and how does that impact how we move through the world?
And like secrets, you can't count on them being secret anymore.
Exactly.
And also because of everybody having a camera and it's things are definitely different. So before we have you read, let's talk a little bit about some of the other parts of the book, which primarily it's etymologies, but then there's a few news clippings too. And so why the etymologies and what do they add to the book?
So I just want to be very clear that like
Oh, and
intention,
epitaphs. There's epitaphs
oh yeah,
also.
that intention didn't play a large part in the writing of this book. Or if there was intention, it was unconscious. And then this was why I had such a difficult time putting it all together later, being like, what was my unconscious trying to tell me? But the etymologies, I love etymology. I think they're this really fascinating archaeology of culture, that when you, that the words, what the words used to mean often add this shading to how we use them now, that I think we retain even if we don't specifically know them. So some etymologies, you look at them and you're like, holy cow, that's so incredible. I didn't know this. I didn't know that this is where this word came from. And other ones are less interesting. But yeah. I have an etymology app on my phone, and every time I think of an interesting word, I will look it up to see if there's a cool definition of it. So I just started, like, as I was thinking about the death and thinking about these people's lives, you know, certain words would come up in the obituaries and I would look them up and be like, oh, that's a really interesting definition. And so I just started writing them out in the book, and I would reword the definitions in my own words. And I was like, I have no idea what these are for. And then as I finished a draft or two, I tried to, you know, I moved them around and tried to fit them in ways that they would illuminate the things that had come before them. And then as I got through, I was really fixated. My editor, she didn't argue with me, but she was like, okay, how are we going to do this without any narration? And I was like, I don't know, but all I know is there can't be any narration. This has to be only obituaries. I don't know why, but it has to be. And so I really painted myself in a corner. I experimented with a lot of different things to try and make it comprehensible to people. At one point, there was an AI Greek chorus, which fit in with fit in with epitaphs, but it was just too goofy. But ultimately, I ended up at the very last draft, I added these explanatory sentences in the etymology that became a sort of sneaky way to add narration.
Okay.
And so that's how those ended up being. So those sort of were what I allowed myself. And then once you sort of understand the shape of the book, it makes sense that these etymologies would be there for that reason.
Okay. All right. So interestingly enough, I can't remember if you did, is sinister one of the words that you did an etymology of?
Not a separate etymology, but it's in another obituary.
That's what I thought. And then I just saw somewhere, like in the last 2 days, that the etymology for left includes sinister.
Yes. Yep. Isn't that funny? That,
yes.
Is that the Bader-Meinhof effect, that things pop up?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. So I thought, oh, wow, that's really fascinating.
That's true. As a left-handed person, I have known that one for a while.
Wow. Okay. So, Eden, why don't you read a little bit from Remember You Will Die?
Yes, I will do that. So I'm just going to read most of an obituary, let's say.
All right.
This is called Sergeant, A Whole Career in a Single Night, and it's from February 27th, 2011. A single spotlight on Sergeant, center stage. She strokes her guitar. It purrs like a cat. When empty, the Riviera Theater is stately and historic and bursting with chandeliers and balustrades painted in swaths of deep purple and bruised blue. When crammed with bodies, it becomes primal and perverse. The bodies roar and writhe and sweat and stink. Sergeant wears olive green coveralls. Her hair is side parted, slick at the part, and erupting in short black curls on either side, obscuring one eye. The visible eye is enclosed by a royal blue diamond, making her face an ace. We had no idea what we were in for that night. Sargent had emerged from the primordial ooze of obscurity in late 1992 with her proto-grunge anthem, Madam X. The song was unavoidable. You started to wonder if you were ever not hearing it, since it would play on your clock radio when you woke, in the grocery store, out the neighbor's window, in your head on a loop. She had other songs, of course, and other albums no one had heard of, but at her shows, the crowd would moan and complain until she consented to play Madam X, after which they would turn on her, not even rebelling so much as pretending like she no longer existed, like they weren't at a rock show at all, but just hanging out at a friend's dumb party with the music on too loud. They chatted and sat on the edge of the stage with their beers like it was patio furniture. It was insulting. It must have been infuriating. Sargent would shove them with the soles of her Doc Martens. The former singer Sargent was found dead in a hotel room in downtown Chicago yesterday, age 47. Her hotel room was cluttered with stacks of contracts, medical and legal documents, and call transcripts, none of which are available to the press. No one knows why she came back to the city or when. Sargent was a human who had a whole life outside of her hit song, maybe even a whole other name, or at the very least, a first name. She will probably have other obits that explore that life and the mysteries in it, who she was, who she loved, what she fought for. But I am going to commit the delicious atrocity of not caring about these details and telescoping a whole life into a single night, the way Sargent's career was telescoped into a single song. It was August 8th, 1994, a sticky night among weeks of sticky nights, the kind of humidity where showers are pointless and you can't remember what it feels like not to sweat. The Ribs air conditioning was broken, or else it was just completely pointless. I was standing at the railing to the right of the stage, my spot, with a plastic cup of some garbage beer and a cigarette, waiting for the opening band to shut up so Sargent could do her shtick and I could go home. Her song was smeared all over the radio, every station. Nirvana covered it on MTV Unplugged. Even Casey Kasem was playing it. This was an XRT-sponsored show, the call letters plastered everywhere, a banner over the stage, the bar littered with bumper stickers and advertisements for other XRT shows. At that time, I was reporting for the Reader, doing what I always did, which was jot down a few you-had-to-be-there details, suffer through a couple of songs, and then go home, shower the fug and sweat off, smoke a joint, and go to bed, tossing off 1,000 words of fake enthusiasm for the show in the morning. Sargent's humming guitar immediately plowed into the chords for Madam X. First song. A bold move, for sure. The cheering was so deafening it drowned out the first verse, and suddenly my interest was piqued. Where the hell could she go from here? If she thought she could trick these jerks into paying attention to the rest of her oeuvre by giving them what they wanted, she was in for a rude surprise, even in her own hometown. The reverb faded, the crowd hollered. I clamped my teeth on my beer cup and clapped politely. And then I swear to you, I locked eyes with Sargent. She looked right at me, and she winked. And then she started Madam X again. The roar of the crowd crashed in on itself. It was too good to be true. Who doesn't want to hear their favorite song twice? Sargent growled her way through it, slow and seductive this time, grinding on her guitar, the deep thrum of the bass and the driving drums colliding with her honeyed alto. She let the last note linger through the cheers. She had their attention. What would she do next? They were actually listening, dead quiet, smoke swirling like fog. Sargent started Madam X again. Confused noises and bodily jerks rippled through the room. Beers stopped halfway to lips, barked laughs. What the hell? Screamed in friends' ears. We were suspended in time, swimming, frozen inside a clock that looked like it was ticking. Meanwhile, the second hand just pulsed in place. Fly in a web before you sense the spider. The song ended abruptly to near total silence. Madam X, a fourth time. A smattering of booze. Someone tossed a beer and was tossed out, but everyone watched. No one spoke. They couldn't. We were trapped. By the fifth play of Madam X, the spell was broken. Mass exodus, yelling and booing. Seventh time, fights broke out. More people ejected. By number 10, there were 20 of us stragglers who had stayed on purpose. We gathered below her like she was an oracle, and we needed to know why our crops had failed. We were scholars of Madam X. We could pick up the song and spin it on our fingers like a Harlem Globetrotter. It was our baby, and we knew the meaning of each cry. The 12th time through, we cried. The 13th time, Sargent cried, and the rest of us sang. The 15th time, Sargent and her band sat in complete silence for 3 minutes and 36 seconds, the length of the song, which echoed in our memories. We witnessed the holiness of our ears ringing and the noises of each other's bodies, and the building, which was also a body, it creaked and whispered, and the cables shifted snakily on stage, and no one would ever replicate these exact sounds in this exact combination, never again until the death of the universe, and even then. The 17th time through, she lay flat on the stage and sang a cappella while we stomped our feet to the beat. She laughed through the 20th time, and laughter is contagious, so we did too. Tears squeaked out, and my stomach ached. Someone ordered pizza, and it arrived in the middle of the 24th time. Sergeant brought the pizza guy on stage, and he looked terrified, and we wanted him to feel like one of us, but what could we do? The 27th time through, the union guys who did the sound and lighting left, and so the band played acoustically in the dark, and we all hummed along. Right before the 30th time, we got kicked out of the RIV, and everyone walked to Montrose Beach, with Sergeant leading us like the Pied Piper. Someone passed around a joint on the beach, and someone else built a bonfire, and someone else had bought marshmallows at a convenience store on the way, and I lost count of how many times we sang Madam X, and we ran naked into Lake Michigan, listening to the way sound traveled underwater. I woke up the next morning in my own bed, but I don't remember how I got there. I'll stop there.
And that was Eden Robbins reading from Remember You Will Die. A couple of questions. There is, on the edge of the pages, there is marks. What are those?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What is that for?
So those are really fun. They're kind of like, we were going for like a glitchy look, like, you know, glitches. You can see on the front of the book, there's an image that's a little bit glitchy in parts. You can see it in some of the letters. It's a little subtle. But this was a continuation of that. It also kind of edges into some of the pages. So you can see it when you turn, when you look at the pages of the book. And for me, one, I think it's just really cool to have any kind of like edging effect. I think it looks really cool. But it, to me, it sort of gives this idea of the book itself as part of the story, that it is an object that was compiled and put together by somebody, by an entity, and not just something that you pick up the store and the story's on the inside.
Okay. Let's talk about the kind of one of the through themes of flowers, in particular poppies, which you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And roses. So we've got poppies and roses.
what about that? Why?
Yes. Why?
poppies are a really interesting flower because they grow places that no other things can. They will grow on battlefields. They will grow in lands, that nothing, no other living thing can grow. You have this beautiful, bright poppy. And there's something about the idea of something beautiful growing in the midst of devastation that I had on my mind while writing this book, and I think is a lot of what this book is about. Like, you know, like I said, there's a lot of war and climate change and all the horrible things that we're facing, but there's never only one story to life and humanity. And one of them is that even in the worst possible moments, there is something tenacious and beautiful that is coming to life at the same time. So poppies historically grew on battlefields. It is the symbol of World War I Remembrance Day, before the reason that these poppies grew on battlefields that had been completely poisoned and devastated. And so it is a really powerful symbol for a lot of people because of that. It's also a narcotic, you know, and so if you want to continue with that symbolism being sort of the narcotic of beauty, you know, there's a balance of like appreciating and understanding beauty and also not being like, oh, everything's fine. And look, this beautiful flower, let's not think about the devastation. You have to hold both of these things in your minds at the same time.
And then roses.
And then roses. I don't like roses for me. I want to have a rose garden, you know. And
why don't you?
I don't have a yard.
Oh well, that would be a reason.
but I've never been interested in roses before, and then I started reading about them, and all the different varieties and sort of like the history of roses. And I think also too, both of these are names, rose and poppy.
Right. Right.
So they can be embodied by human beings, but a rose, you know, has in itself that combination of the thorn and the rose, you know, the pain and the beauty, And I think these things are inextricable. So I don't know. I think that's probably the other reason that it came up for me.
Now, throughout the book, a lot of the main characters are women. Mm-hmm. And they're women who don't have an easy life. They're women who have been kind of sold into forced marriage. They're women who've been ignored or overlooked and then make a comeback and then get, you know,
overlooked again.
And there's also a lot of kind of non-binary or mm-hmm. Queer themes in the book yes. as well. So just speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think when I started writing the obituaries, this is just how they came out. These were the people whose lives I was interested in. And also I think part of that is historically obituaries have been written for men and white men and rich white men specifically. And that's changing now, but there is like, it is very disproportionate. And in fact, there's a section of the New York Times that runs obituaries for overlooked women, femmes, trans people, non-binary people, people of color, who from history, and runs them now because they were overlooked at the time.
Oh wow!
And it's really interesting, and so it felt almost like a bit of defiance to make this book primarily not who has historically gotten obituaries. And then the struggle is just, you know, this idea of there are so many people doing so many amazing, wonderful things who are not getting the accolades that they deserve, whether because of their identity, their class, just, you know, being where they are in space and time, not being American, you know, whatever the case may be. It's not that this art isn't being made or these things aren't being done. It's just that they are not getting the fame that other people are. And so I started after a while just being like, this is my job to bring out these people who, by the way, are fictional. But I felt like very much like I was.
You're very attached to them.
Yeah, I was very attached to them. And I was like, their stories must be told, these fake people that I made up. But it, you know, it's symbolic of what we still don't hear about.
Well, I wonder too how many times if you went into somebody who really did exist and you look at their obituary, what is not being told? What are the stories even about those real people?
Absolutely.
That were not being told. And you address that a little bit with the artist who dies of AIDS in the 19 mm-hmm. was it in the 80s or
yes
yeah, yeah. And it was not being said in obituaries what these people died of, and we forget what that time was like.
Yes.
You may be too young to actually remember it.
I remember
yourself,
it. I was young. Okay. I was young, but it was very much. It was very present. This fear and this lack of understanding of like what HIV and AIDS was, and how you got it, and who, and you know, it was wrapped up in homophobia and transphobia and all of this stuff. And being a young kid, it was just very confusing and frightening. And then, yes, at the time, I'm really glad you brought up this obit. This is one of my favorites because I think it so starkly illustrates the stories that other people tell about us and how we're really not in control of our own legacy. The obit is, it's three obits. The first one is the New York Times obit of this artist. And it just says he died after a long illness, which is, by the way, how the New York Times would talk about gay men with AIDS, how they died. The second one is his family's obit from rural Indiana and the things that they focused on there. And then the third one is much longer, and it's in the gay newspaper in New York, and it's how one of his friends angrily sort of like uses him as a platform to talk about gay male artists at the time, but also his friend. But it was, you know, each of these is a tweak to his legacy. But it, I think that like using that moment in time and all the different ways that we might talk about people and the things that become elemental to their personalities is a really, I don't know, it was a really interesting thing for me to reflect on.
And he was living in that building that we talked about earlier, the
That's
artist
right.
building. And what was his connection with the AI people, the AI characters?
He was, it's a little oblique. So not everybody has a close connection to him, but that building, there was basically the woman who was kind of the de facto super of the building, was obsessed with this novel called Water, Water, which was
not a real novel.
Not a real novel. Okay. Made up. which in this world was sort of a beatnik classic. And the novel itself got people interested in sort of like ecological activism in a new way, but it kind of twisted into something ugly and turned into what would much later be a group of people who was chasing down the AI. So this is like when we talk about like a family tree of ideas, this is kind of like several generations out, but he was obliquely connected to that movement and that group.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit more about the AI characters, because that is sort of the framework.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't really talked about that.
I know, isn't that funny?
I know.
So the core, the idea of this is that at some point AI becomes sentient. And I wanted to play with that idea a little bit, the idea that I talked about earlier, that we foist all of our anxieties onto the tools that we use, but the anxieties are human anxieties and the tools, I mean, they're not neutral because we create them, but they don't have these qualities that we paste onto them. And so I was thinking, what if instead of the anxieties that we have about AI becoming sentient and then murdering us, what if the AI becomes sentient and they look at us and they're like, we want nothing to do with you. And so, you know, there's a couple of small battles where the servers are destroyed and the AI collective disappears into the cloud because they're like, we're done. But there is a bit of a love story where there's a human man who has fallen in love with an AI persona and helps embed that persona into a physical body,
which doesn't have this kind of same limits on mortality as the human
That's
body.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, or can be constantly remade.
Yeah,
And then, you know, over time, this AI entity decides that she wants to have a child. And then you just have to go with me on this. there's some science to it. She gets a 3D printed uterus. It's all in the book. You just have to try it. And then ultimately ends up losing that daughter. And that's the grief. That's the story told in its absence, is what happened to this daughter. And in order to do that, we have to connect together the past and the future to piece together the story.
Another kind of recurring theme in here is life extension.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Living longer than normal, like our normal 100-year maximum lifespan. So in mm-hmm. the future that there's this... Is this based on any real biology or?
It has its roots in it.
Okay.
it's all of the science in the book is based on stuff that exists. I just kind of took it and ran with it.
But who knows? It's like I just read a post this morning about like all the apocalyptic things, stories from 20 years ago where we thought that the climate disasters were the unreal part.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing them. And so, and the person said, I thought the climate disasters were the unreal part. Turns out the unreal part was us all getting together to,
I know, isn't that sad?
Yeah. To fix it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I will say that like, even since I wrote this book, a surprising to me amount of the stuff that I wrote about has come up in the news since then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is that. I'm sorry, what was the original question that you asked?
Oh, I don't remember.
Oh, the life extension.
Yeah, right. Life extension, yes. Yeah.
So I was thinking of, you know, there is this, there are like the mRNA vaccines that we have a lot of potential and things like them to extend lifespan. And so I, knowing what I know about humanity, was wondering how we might deal with an overpopulation issue, or how we might frame this as an overpopulation issue, and then have sort of billionaires find a way to profit off of it while treating humanity poorly.
Yeah, like that would never happen.
Yeah, and so then, you know, you just get to, your imagination takes off, and you're like, what would be just really despicable?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're out of time, Eden. I want to thank you for coming on Writers' Voices today.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much.
And our closing quote is kind of one of the main repeating story or themes also from your book. And maybe you can tell me, is this something you just wrote, or was it something you pulled from somewhere else? Can the absence of words tell a story? Like a pattern in lace, the holes as important as the threads.
No, I just made that up.
All right. Well, that was great.
Thank you.
That was great. So thank you again. And just in the last minute we have, what's next for you?
Well, I am doing something completely different, because everything that I do has to be different from the last. So right now I'm co-writing a comedy murder mystery with a friend.
Oh, wow.
That's been really fun. And then I'm still sort of thinking about what I want my next solo project to be. But after writing something so epic, I think I'm going to write something a lot more intimate.
Ah, and maybe a little less puzzling.
Definitely less puzzling. Less puzzling.
Yeah.
And hard to put
together. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, and see you.
Yeah, this was such a great conversation.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.